From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There's a saying, as goes California, so goes the nation. Big changes that happen in that big state have a way of creating change across America. Well, along comes Proposition 61, the Drug Price Relief Act, on the ballot in November. And if you believe the polling, it's going to pass. It says the state should bargain down the price it pays for prescription drugs. With huge drug price hikes all over the headlines, it's a hot topic. This hour on Point, Californians take on Big Pharma. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are high drug prices the way we pay for the miracle of modern medicine, or simple profiteering? And what's the fix? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from California's state capital, Sacramento, is Christopher Catalago, reporter for the Sacramento Bee. Christopher, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good. So Prop 61, it would do what exactly, Christopher?
So Prop 61 is a ballot measure proposed by the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, based in Los Angeles. And this initiative would prohibit state government entities in California from spending more on prescription drugs than the lowest price paid by the federal VA.
By the Veterans Administration, why would they hook California drug prices to VA drug prices, what they pay?
The VA essentially gets deals from the drug makers. This initiative in particular would apply to direct state purchases, as well as when the state is the ultimate buyer of the drug. The proponents wanted to start with the state. They do exempt managed care programs funded through Medi-Cal, which is the Medicare program in California. So the actual number that this would apply to is far smaller than the whole population. But what the proponents say is that it would essentially create a cascade effect, and in turn, downward pressure on all drug prices.
So this would only apply to Californians who get their health care through the state. I'm reading here that would be about 4.2 million people out of many, many more than that in California. But they think it would have a knock-on effect. Given that it doesn't apply to everyone, is there support for it? What's the public response been, Christopher?
So far, the polling across several public polls has shown a strong majority of support. The caution there is that some of these polls have had a fairly high number of undecided voters, and I think that is due to sort of a mixed fiscal analysis written by the state's legislative analyst's office, which basically says this could generate some state savings, though that amount would depend on how on the challenges to implementing the policy and basically how the drug manufacturers respond. So, we have heard all kinds of things from pulling certain drugs off the market to potentially pulling out of the state. These are the sorts of things we've heard in the past on other ballot measures. The counter to that from proponents would be, this is one of the largest markets out there. So would you really want to be taking yourself out of this market? Proponents would say that that's essentially sort of an empty threat that won't happen.
Congress has put up a pretty big block to even the government negotiating on drug prices. Everybody knows that. But the VA can. How much lower than ordinary prices does the VA tend to pay? Is it a quarter off, half off? Do you have a sense of that?
I don't. It's really, really hard to say. I don't know that we know. There's sort of mixed reporting on whether we know the amounts paid for each of these drugs. It's also unclear what might happen to a number of these rebates that certain groups, including the state, currently get. Opponents of this have said that some of those rebates would clearly be in jeopardy, and so that would have a big effect on how much of a discount you'd ultimately get, even if this were to pass. So, this legislative analyst's impact statement is just very unclear and doesn't allow either side to give a very, clear understanding of what effect this would have, despite, pretty full-throated case that proponents are making that this would obviously lower drug prices.
And yet we know that across the country people have been kind of stunned by some of the headlines around prescription drug prices, packets of EpiPens for $600 up from $100-something, $1,000 hepatitis C pills, and on and on and on. There's a lot of attention on this. We know it's a big driver of health costs. Let's listen to a little bit of the kind of messages that Californians are hearing. If they can bring prices down, even for a portion of Californians, proponents see this as leverage to potentially bring prices down across the country. Of course, that is the industry's attention, too. We'll look at that. Here's from the lobbying group Yes on 61. This is Proposition 61. Argues that California proposition would lower astronomical prices of drugs, including life-saving ones. Here's Dr. Otto Yang of UCLA speaking in one of their ads.
What if there were a pill to cure cancer, but drug companies charge $10,000 a pill or $1 million? Unfortunately, that is not too far off. This pill, which cures a deadly liver disease, costs more than $90,000 for a course of treatment. This November, we can change that by voting yes on Prop 61, which will save Californians $1 billion annually in drug costs.
Just cast a vote and you can change the high cost of prescription drugs. That can sound pretty appealing. Of course, at this point, it would only apply to some Californians. Those against it say, well, that's one of their big themes. It wouldn't cover everybody. Here's an ad from No Prop 61.
1.5 million insured by Covered California are out. Even the 5 million Californians who have no health insurance are out. In fact, the measure excludes approximately 88% of Californians and only applies to a handful of arbitrarily selected programs serving less than 12% of the population.
Christopher Catalago covers all this for the Sacramento Bee. Christopher, it may only cover a small part of the population, but it's got the attention of the pharmaceutical industry in a pretty big way. They have reportedly put together a $100 million fund or something like that to fight this.
Yeah, the amount put in opposition is certainly nearing that $100 million figure. You know, there are all kinds of reports on both sides. What you could probably say is this is certainly a threat and something that they don't want to see. They don't want to see this duplicated. There have been a whole host of various legislative remedies that have been proposed over the years in California, the latest of which was a sort of a transparency bill that would have required the pricing to be disclosed, and that ultimately failed. And so what you're seeing and what you've just previewed with the ad from the proponents is a campaign largely based on sort of the anger that's out there directed at the drug companies for these high prices. The big question here is whether that public unrest will ultimately translate into a win. I mean, you can talk about the problem out there, and you can try to capitalize on the anxieties over high prices, but does that ultimately lead to a yes vote for this proposal? And what you obviously see with these ballot measures is an attempt to cause doubts and confusions in the minds of voters that while there may have to be a fix to this, this is not the right solution. And politically, that's what we're seeing. And you know, that could be why we're seeing, the high number of undecided so far. The election, obviously, November 8th, so that number will have to come down. And that large amount of money that we're seeing come in, a huge amount of that gets pumped into television ads.
That is pharmaceutical money against this proposition.
Exactly. What I would note is that, we have about almost $15 million on the yes side, which is not a small amount. While they will likely be outspent by a great deal, it's a significant amount to get your message out on the airwaves in California. This is not an underfunded campaign. We've seen campaigns in the past with a couple million bucks that can barely qualify for the ballot have a very hard time pressing their case to voters. I don't expect to see that from the proponents of this initiative. They, while outspent, will be able to make their case, and their case is largely prices are too high. You need to do something about this. These drug makers essentially prioritize profits over you and your health. And, you know, while this has this narrow application, you know, we're the ones bringing forward a solution, maybe not the perfect solution, but one that's on the ballot and one you can vote for.
Anything in this country that would crack the wall against controls on drug prices, though, turns people's attention in a hurry. Proponents of this one talk about, of course, the drug that went from $1,350 to $750, 5,000% increase. I think that was Michael Shkreli's drug. Talk about a cancer drug that costs $300,000 a year. And they're putting out this, that the average annual cost of specialty drugs widely used is $53,000 greater than the nation's median household income. At $52,000, three and a half times the average annual Social Security benefit. I mean, this is a hot issue in a lot of people's minds after the headlines we've seen this year, Christopher. And California has a history of passing ballot measures that end up having a big impact across the country.
Yeah, California has been a bellwether, pace setter, whatever you want to call it, on a whole host of socially progressive issues. You know, they're hoping that this is another one of those. We've seen, obviously, these huge increases in prices in the news. We've seen the discussion of drug prices in the presidential race. You know, this could be sort of, for lack of a better term, kind of an anger election where voters are sort of airing their frustrations at the ballot. And, you know, I think that's another thing that the proponents of this hope to capitalize on is this anxiety about these prices rising and this being their solution. They're hoping that, you know, what we're seeing on the national level with frustration sort of boils over into this initiative.
Christopher Catalago with the Sacramento Bee in the California State Capitol. Thank you very much for joining us today, Christopher.
Thanks a lot.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are talking this hour about a big California ballot initiative to turn back the price of prescription drugs. In the time of $600 EpiPens and $1,000 hepatitis C pills, it's got big pharma spending, or putting together, we're told, about $100 million to try and shut this ballot initiative on the ballot November 8th to shut it down. You can join the conversation this hour. Have you been watching this? Have you seen what pharmaceutical companies are charging for some of these prescriptions? And do high, super high pharmaceutical prices look to you like just reflecting the cost of research, the cost of business, or do they look like highway robbery? Californians will have a chance to potentially influence the future of pricing right across the country. That has the attention of the industry in a big way. There being one communication there is being quoted between pharmaceutical executives saying this would be a disaster for pricing for the big companies. Of course, they've been in the hot seat lately. Just last week, pharmaceutical company CEO at Mylan, Heather Bresch, defended the cost of her company's EpiPens during her testimony before Congress on oversight and government reform. They've gone from about $100 to about $600. Here's the back and forth.
You got a drug that's been on the market for 100 years. Costs roughly a dollar. The actual juice that's in here that you need costs about a dollar.
No, sir, we pay $69 for the cost of goods for the EpiPen.
Okay, argument over that. Is it cents in that $600? Is it a buck? Is it $69? Either way, it looks like a big markup. It looks like it. And people are upset all over the place. Here's another one of these ads or testimonials for California's Prop 61, the Drug Price Relief Act. Here's Al Sharpton getting in on it.
Obscenely high prescription drug prices are literally a matter of life and death. Cancer drugs have doubled in the last 10 years thanks to greedy drug companies. We wholeheartedly support the Drug Price Relief Act on the California ballot this November. Let's send the greedy drug companies a loud message. No more profits over patients.
Okay, but the industry's pushing back hard. They put together something like $100 million to fight this. Here's an ad from the No on 61 group. It says it would actually lead to more government bureaucracy and increasing some costs.
Fact, the measure would exclude 88% of all Californians. Fact, the remaining 12% could face reduced access to vitally needed medicines. Fact, the measure would lead to more government bureaucracy and red tape that taxpayers would pay for.
Yes, it doesn't cover most Californians. It's for those covered by the state. But when California gets into an issue like this, it can have ripples right across the country. You can join us. Are you sympathetic to Californians looking for some way to put the brakes on pharmaceutical drug prices, to bring prices down or not? Let's turn to California right now. With us from Los Angeles is Dr. Jonathan Fielding. He's a professor of health policy and management and pediatrics at UCLA, former commissioner of public health for the state of Commonwealth of Massachusetts, former director of public health and health officer for the LA County. Dr. Jonathan Fielding, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
It's great to have you here. And from New York, Dr. Joel Zinberg joins us, lawyer and physician, visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, practicing surgeon at the Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. Dr. Zinberg, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
Dr. Fielding, let me come first to you. You're right there in California, in Los Angeles. What do you think of this ballot initiative? Lots of things can get ballot initiatives going. They're not always good ideas. Is this one?
Well, you're absolutely right. This is capitalizing on the anger, and it's understandable given some of the huge increases in prices, and you've given a few, but one antibiotic, doxycycline, went from $20 a bottle to almost $1,900 a bottle, and we know about Mylan. There's Marathon purchased Nitroprost and Isoprel, and they tripled the price and more. So I think there's plenty of examples of that. And the other side of that is how much CEOs make in the pharmaceutical industry. They averaged about 71% more than the other CEOs in the 500, top 500.
Which are already pretty high. Okay.
Which are already pretty high. So there's a lot of but on the other hand, there's a question about what impact this would do. And I think the fact you have doctors on the side of concern is understandable, because we have pricing. Nobody knows exactly what's being paid. We need transparency. Without that, everybody's afraid. And the pharmacist can say, you know what, we're going to have to raise prices, or we're going to have to take some drugs off the formulary or whatever. And that obviously gets people very concerned. I think this is a national issue. It's going to be very hard to deal with it on simply a state level. What should have happened is there should have been in the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, the government should have been able to negotiate for Medicare Part D. They have the biggest purchasing power with pharmaceutical companies, but the pharmaceutical company lobby was too strong, and Congress certainly wouldn't buy it.
Why did they go to the Veterans Administration? Is that the only place that the government is negotiating on drug prices right now, the only place they're allowed to by congressional mandate?
No, it's the most obvious one. They have federal law that says you have to have a certain level, and you can't get above that. But it's tricky because it doesn't cover all the discounts, all the rebates. So the VA is a national program. That's one reason to do it. But it is the one that's set. The Medicaid programs are able to negotiate, but that's on a state-by-state basis. It's interesting here that the HMOs, the health plans that one of the sponsors runs, are excluded from coverage. But I think this is a general reaction to saying, you know what, enough's enough. And every other country has some form of regulation. You know, when you give somebody a patent, it's basically a monopoly on that drug. And the question is, you know, why a national basis? Shouldn't there be some effort to try and control prices? And many people feel that the Fed Food and Drug Administration should, in addition to being able to look at safety and efficacy, should be able to look at cost effectiveness and what the impact is on human health in determining pricing. Right now, they don't determine pricing at all. And most other countries have some mechanism to do that, both the initial price and the increases.
People looking for somewhere to get a handle on this issue. California, a state that has been a very effective launch pad for big changes around the way we oversee and legislate in the past, could happen in the pharmaceutical realm as well, even though it only covers part of the state's population. Dr. Jonathan Fielding, please stand by there in Los Angeles. Dr. Joel Zinberg, in New York, you're not favoring this. You see problems with it. Why? What?
Well, I think this is a well-intentioned effort to address rising drug prices. And I do think that this is something that's attracted a lot of attention because of several very well-publicized price increases. Those, I think, are not the norm, though. If you really look at the industry as a whole, prices have been going up, but not by the for most drugs, by the astronomical amounts that you see with the EpiPen or that you see with the Shkreli case. There was a 5,000% increase overnight. In the case of EpiPen, you had a 500% increase over the space of several years. Most drugs are going up far smaller amounts.
And yet, even if it's 10% or 20% a year, and it certainly can be, isn't it a major driver of our healthcare costs, which are pretty enormous?
No, it actually isn't a major driver. Part of what's going on is specialty drugs, which are relatively new, and that includes biologics, which are these complex molecules made mm-hmm. in living systems. Those are relatively new, and those are quite expensive to develop, and the pricing has been very high. However, pharmaceuticals as a whole have been relatively constant as a percentage of our healthcare expenditures. So, no, pharmaceuticals really are not what's driving increases. And I think the problem, while this is well-intentioned, Proposition 61, it's not clear how it's going to work, and it's not clear if it will work. And unfortunately, I think it could have some unintended consequences, like increasing the costs that they end up paying, by narrowing the choice of drugs that Californians have, and that it may negatively impact the California biotech industry, which is actually the largest in the nation. So I think really what we should be doing is addressing this problem on a national level. I agree with Dr. Fielding on that, although I disagree with his prescription, not on the state level. And I think we ought to be aiming towards increasing innovation, increasing competition, and that competition will drive prices down.
But on a national level, the pharmaceutical industry has been very, very assiduous in blocking efforts to rein in prices, as far as I can see. I mean, I'm reading here headlines all over the place about how, you know, when proposals are made, they step in and Congress responds and the things go nowhere.
There's no question that given the opportunity, the industry will try to preserve high prices for their individual drugs. So, for example, often what they'll do is various maneuvers to try to extend the life of their patent. But I think what you have to understand is what a patent is. A patent is a period of exclusivity where the person or the company that has developed a particular innovation has the exclusive right to market the drug. And during that period, you're getting a reward. That's what drives them to develop it in the first place. So you can't hope to continue to have innovation if you're then going to control the prices that people get.
But it's not just the specialty drug makers who got involved here. I mean, when the idea of letting negotiation happen around Medicare, Part D was in there, the whole pharma industry lobbied very hard to prevent that. I mean, they came in there in a huge way. That's for the whole price structure, is it not?
Well, I think the Medicare Part D is a good example. I mean, Medicare Part D, you're dealing with a huge portion of the patient population in this country, some 55 million people. In addition,
isn't that where we should be thinking about?
Well, no. I think the problem is, and those, by the way, those are older patients and they're sicker patients. They disproportionately use prescription drugs. That's not a negotiation. That's a price control. That will be a dictating price. It will be much more akin to what happens overseas where you have foreign governments setting prices and rationing treatments and in many cases not allowing treatments to be available to people in their countries altogether.
Maybe we need some brute
force. I think
force.
Negotiation is the wrong term. Well, I think Dr. Fielding used the hepatitis C drugs as an example, mm-hmm. and I think that's actually a very good example of what can happen.
These are the $1,000 a pill drugs?
Right. These are the ones that attracted the most attention are the Gilead drugs, mm-hmm. Sovaldi and Harvoni, which are about $80,000 to $90,000 list price. But, of course, no one pays the list price. The various rebates and discounts are negotiated, and substantial discounts are negotiated. So the list price alone is misleading. In addition, those are particularly valuable drugs. They They cure people who would go on to have chronic liver disease, need years of basically ineffective and expensive treatment.
Yep.
Many of those people go on to need liver transplants, which are hundreds of thousands of dollars.
I get that they're valuable, and I get that we need that high-level research. But still, when CEO compensation in pharma is 70% above already high compensation across the Fortune 500, that gets people's attention. And people may even wonder about experts, you know, like yourself. I mean, do you receive money from the pharmaceutical industry for defending their pricing structure, Dr. Zinberg?
I do not.
Well, that's good to
know. I'm not defending each and every aspect, but I think what you see in the hepatitis case is there are now competitors to those Gilead drugs. Several other new and effective hepatitis C drugs have come on the market, and that's driving prices down.
Well, we'll see. We'll see where those prices go. We're looking at California's big ballot initiative 61, the Drug Price Relief Act, and whether it might pass, what it might mean if it does. Dr. Fielding, there in Los Angeles, I hear you.
Yes. Fine. Are we on?
Yes, we're on.
Okay. I think there are a couple of misconceptions. One is, we all respond to incentives. And what you have in the pharmaceutical company is they're responding to incentives. So I don't think we can blame them uniquely, although I do think there's some examples of rapacious actions that are really disappointing because they really make drugs less affordable. But what we need is something nationally that says, this is the price. You have to negotiate it. It can't be above this. You can't increase, for example, in 2014, the best study I know saw the brand drugs increase by almost 15% on average. Mm-hmm. And the specialty drugs, which Dr. Zinberg was talking about, went up almost 10%. Well, what else in our lives go up that way? Certainly not salaries, certainly not purchasing power. Mm-hmm. So this is still a huge issue, but we shouldn't just blame the pharmaceutical companies. We should look at Congress, because Congress decided not to put that in the Medicare Part D negotiation in the bill.
But maybe that's why you have to act in California, because Congress seems stymied here, I mean, no small part by pharmaceutical industry lobbying.
Yeah, I think the difficulty is we really don't know what the impact of this is going to be. It could hurt a number of people. It could help a number of people. And it's very hard to know without transparency in pricing and without some negotiation or price setting by national organizations, particularly the Food and Drug Administration, it's going to be very hard. So one can argue back and forth whether it's going to save or cost money and who it's going to save and who it's going to cost for. The answer is we don't know. No, because we don't have transparency. Nobody can tell you today, at least in open, in the open, mm-hmm. what exactly is being paid by the VA.
You can't blame people for trying to get some leverage in here somewhere in this system. Let's get our callers in here, if I may. Stefan is calling from New Lisbon, Wisconsin. Stefan, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
I have epilepsy. My pills went up from $15 to $100 a piece.
Mm-hmm.
Bush's
over what period? Just in one jump, Stefan? Just one leap from 15 to 100?
Well, it went from 15 to 36 in 1 month. Then after the next month, it went up to 100.
Was that because your insurance changed or because the price of the drug changed?
No,
do you know?
I'm paying cash.
Okay, out of pocket. Wow.
So, yes, sir. And may I then digress to what the Bush administration gave $500 million to pharma to create drugs. If they're going to be creating drugs that on our cash, on our money, they should also be competing. Competition is supposed to be the bedrock of capitalism.
This was back with the medical reform bill. $15 to $100, and you're paying cash. That gets people's attention in a hurry. Dr. Zinberg, do we not have sufficient competition here?
I don't know the particular drug he's referring to, but in some instances you don't have sufficient competition. And ideally what happens is if prices rise high enough, competition comes in one of two forms. either a new drug, that branded drug that will compete with the older drug, or generics for that drug. And part of the problem you have now is a relatively cumbersome process to get new drugs approved. Even for the FDA, which has what's for generics, what's called an abbreviated new drug application.
Joel Zinberg, would you hold the thought there right there? We have to take a short break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about a big California ballot initiative to turn back the price of prescription drugs in the time of $600 EpiPen packets and $1,000 pills for Hep C. It's got Big Pharma spending maybe $100 million to shut down this California proposition. The Drug Price Relief Act, they will vote on November 8th. Opinion polls show it's got pretty strong support. Doesn't apply to all Californians, just those insured by the state. But that's not a small number. And what happens in California can very often ripple across the country. That has the pharmaceutical industry's attention in a big way. They've described it as a pricing disaster for the industry if it goes through. You can join us this hour. Are you sympathetic or not to Californians looking for some way to put the brakes on high drug prices? We'll also look before this hour is over at the proposed merger of Walgreens and Rite Aid, two very big drugstore chains around this country. With us this hour, Dr. Joel Zinberg. He's a surgeon at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, also a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, physician and lawyer. From Los Angeles, Dr. Jonathan Fielding is with us from UCLA. You can join us as well. Lots of response here online. Thinkin says, the research is done. The product has been out for years. Why does the price need to skyrocket up? Elizabeth writes to us on Twitter, Big Pharma is all about the profit, hence why so few invest in cure research. Chronic illness means big bucks, she says. We need price caps. On the other hand, questions here as well, and I'll put them to my guests. Here's one a listener asks, I wonder if price controls in other nations, are why we've seen such insane inflation here. For the only market where they can make a profit, it would make sense for them to keep jacking the prices to make up for price controls elsewhere. And then there's a question of just, what's it worth to you? Todd says, the question is, what's your life worth? Is $1,000 too much to pay to save your life? Is $500 without life-saving drugs created by a pharmaceutical business, you wouldn't have that choice. You would be dead. Dr. Fielding, what about this question about the controls in other nations? Are those leading to higher prices here in the States? Is this where pharmaceutical companies bring home the profits to help them keep going?
There's no question that the prices in the U.S. are much higher than the prices in virtually all other high-income countries. The pharmaceutical industry will tell you that that's essential because that's where they get the money to reinvest into new drugs and improvements. But it's not at all clear. And I think that there's probably at least some good evidence that they're making money in the other countries. But remember that they make more money on average than most other industries. So it's really hard to know how much of that comes from the U.S. versus other countries, and also how much is really devoted to breakthrough drugs as opposed to kind of, me too drugs. I think that we have to look at this nationally. And one of the problems, although not everybody wants to think about it, is the problem of lobbying Congress. If you look at how much pharma gives Congress people, you look at the Citizens United decision and others, you find out that they're very strongly influenced by the pharmaceutical industry. And is that what we really want to see? Is that who you want to see making the decisions? Well, Congress has to make some of these decisions if we're going to make progress on this. Whether this can be the first step is really very, very very hard to know.
But that's exactly where the logjam, or at least the block has been. And let's go to Des Moines, Iowa. Susie's calling. Hi, Susie. You are on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I kind of wanted to know from your panel, how much do they really think this is from just the general market failure of healthcare in this country? A couple of the problems are maybe we don't take a good enough cost-benefit analysis on these new vaginal drugs being developed. In Great Britain, you know, we have socialized medicine in this country, too. We just don't want to admit it because, you know, any developed country that doesn't let people die in the streets, you're paying to keep people alive. Now, you can do it inefficiently and have them all go to the ER or things, but I think a lot of this is, do we really take a good look at all these newfangled drugs being developed? And does the true benefit or the quality life years they add to somebody's life really justify the cost? And can we do it for everybody? We're going to have a moral and ethical, rational discussion in this country that, yes, we have socialized medicine. What is the ethical and moral level of care we can provide? And then, no, we can't give everybody two organ transplants. We can't pay for your newfangled drug that matches, you know, your particular genetic makeup.
Susie, I get your point, but isn't, when you start weighing what life is worth in that way, then doesn't it become even more important to have an eye on drug prices and make sure that the prices themselves are, yes, they have to work so the whole system works, but also ethical in some way?
Well, that's what other countries do, though. We have, first have to admit we do have socialized medicine. We've decided we're going to keep people alive. So yeah. What's a reasonable cost to the public for the benefit of individuals? And I'm sorry, that's what Great Britain does. You know, if somebody doesn't have, like, let's say if it's more than $20,000 to add one quality life year to your life, then that drug doesn't get approved.
Susie, let us pick it up. I mean, in that case, it really matters how much those pills cost. If it's one pill for $20,000, you're not going to live as long as if it's 2,000 pills for $20,000. Dr. Zinberg, what about this issue of efficacy? And are we getting, you know, I hate to put it so crassly, but the bang for the buck on these very high-priced drugs?
Well, I think in some cases, yes, in some cases, no. And I think your guest has tapped into something that's very important. That's been a failure, I think, of the medical profession, my colleagues. We haven't paid enough attention to the value we get from particular treatments. We've been, particularly in certain areas like oncology, too willing to utilize high-priced drugs in situations where they really have very low probability of efficacy and very low likelihood of extending life or making life better. In
fact, isn't that an argument for putting some brakes on pricing? Because
That's not an argument for putting brakes on pricing. What it is an argument is for physicians to start looking more carefully at this issue. So, for example, several years ago, there was a new oncologic agent, a cancer treatment that had come out, and it was manufactured by Sanofi, and they were trying to market it to Memorial Sloan Kettering here in New York City.
Yeah.
And it was less or no more effective than drugs that were about half the price. So Memorial said, no, we're not buying that
drug. But that's
drug.
Not
we're
happening not,
so
then, broadly.
So then,
I mean, we're paying
so
top
then,
dollar, and Susie says maybe for half-baked drugs.
So then Sanofi came back and cut the price in half. And now that has to happen more often. Physicians have to be willing to say, I'm not going to use that drug. It's too expensive. So, for example, in the EpiPen example, the active ingredient in EpiPen is epinephrine. As your clip said, it costs a buck for that. So physicians and nurses and EMT crews are perfectly capable of drawing up epinephrine in a syringe and injecting it without having to use an EpiPen.
But
they
can
do it
carry
for a few
syringe out in your backpack when you're, you know, heading up the mountainside.
No, individuals can't,
The
individuals aren't the only ones who use EpiPen. So that's what's going to happen. They're going to substitute that. Trained individuals will substitute that, and they have to start doing that.
Meanwhile, the prices go right on. Dr. Fielding, our time grows short. Does it look like this may pass in California? And if it does, do you see this as the beginning of a national pushback, which you're looking for, on pricing?
It's hard to know whether this is going to be the beginning. This is going to tip things over. But I think what's important is this conversation, because we have to get to the root of the problem. We're spending in this country 50% more than any other developed country per capita. So it's not just a question of pharmaceutical. It's a question of how we practice medicine in general. And unless that conversation gets more enlightened, you can't expect individual consumers to know how to make all these decisions. And you have to provide the right incentives. And I'm not sure within our current system we have all the right incentives.
Once again, California gets our attention and makes us focus on a very big issue here. I want to thank the two of you for being with us today. Dr. Jonathan Fielding from UCLA, thank you for joining us from Los Angeles.
Thank you, Tom.
And from New York and Mount Sinai Hospital, Dr. Joel Zinberg. Dr. Zinberg, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
In a moment, we look at pharmacy retail chain Walgreens' plan to buy up rival Rite Aid. This is On Point. So the pharmacy chain Walgreens is waiting for federal approval to buy up the competitor Rite Aid, a big consolidation in the retail pharmacy sector to take on rival CVS. For more on this, we're joined from New York by Jonathan Palmer. He's Bloomberg Intelligence Analyst and reports on the retail pharmacy sector. Jonathan Palmer, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So Walgreens, Rite Aid, CVS, how do these rank in terms of 1, 2, 3? What's the relative scale of these three?
So right now, CVS is the largest pharmacy in terms of the number of retail stores with about 9,700. They're followed by Walgreens with about 8,200. And in third place, we have Rite Aid with about 4,500 stores. So the acquisition of Rite Aid by Walgreens would bring the combined total for the two companies somewhere in the neighborhood of 12,000 pharmacies.
It would be number one. Is bigger always better if you're in this business? What's Walgreens pushing for here?
Well, we've seen scale and the drive for scale across most of healthcare. Acquisitions are a big driver, you know, across every subsector, whether it's pharmaceuticals or pharmacies or medical technology. But for the most part, generally speaking, bigger is better. There's economies of scale. There's purchasing power. You can spread costs across a greater fixed cost base.
Why is Rite Aid available? Why was it on the market?
Well, Rite Aid had been struggling for a number of years, and the management team there finally was able to turn the business around and start to show growth again. At the same time, they improved the profitability. And so they made themselves somewhat of an attractive target because there's not that many assets out there that are of the scale with about 4,000 stores.
Can you describe geographically where these three chains are most dominant or most present, CVS, Walgreens, Rite Aid?
Sure. So Walgreens is based in Illinois, and as you would expect with their headquarters being there, they're predominantly Midwest focus with a lot of strength in that region. That's not to say they're not a national chain, but their core markets are in the Midwest. Rite Aid is based out of Pennsylvania and has historically been strong on the coasts, on the East Coast and the West Coast. CVS is based out of New England and Rhode Island, and well, they're pretty national as well, but historically they've been more of an East Coast footprint.
What is good for consumers here? If you got super consolidation, we've been talking about drug prices in this hour, and I don't know if the ultimate, you know, the pharmacist at the window where you actually pick it up has any power over that or not. But is consolidation good? And of course, there's everything else here. There's toothpaste and aspirin and all the rest. But what's good for consumers?
Well, it depends on who you're talking to. You know, most of us have insurance in some form or another, and for the most part are somewhat indifferent to which pharmacy we go to, whether it's a Rite Aid or a Walgreens or a CVS or even a Walmart pharmacy. The real concern is for the consumer who doesn't have insurance, and these are called cash-paying consumers, and they don't have a lot of choices, and the price of the drugs matter. So the concern of the government is that in some of these markets where potentially there aren't a lot of competitors, if Walgreens and Rite Aid are really the only games in town, they might potentially jack up the price for the cash-paying consumer.
What about just in general? I mean, you know, it used to be mom-and-pop drugstores all over the place. Now, many, 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 many of those are gone. I assume between the three of these, this is a dominant share of what you'd find in a drugstore being sold. Is it not?
Well, interestingly, these are very large chains, but the drugstore market or the pharmacy market in the U.S. has about 67,000 or more pharmacies. So there's still a number of independents out there. We still have a couple big players in Walmart who has about 5,000 stores. There's the supermarket chains, whether it's Kroger's or Safeway and Albertsons or Publix. These are pretty dominant chains as well in their local markets. So there's still a lot of opportunity from the big three to that 67,000.
And for the cash-paying consumer who doesn't have insurance or sufficient insurance when they're paying for their drugs, their medications, what's the difference? If you get more consolidation in this industry, what might they face?
Well, I think the concern is that they'll always face higher costs when they go to get their prescriptions filled, and that's something the FTC is working to, you know, make sure doesn't happen in this particular deal.
How do they do that? Is that their main consideration on just a green light or not, or do they have more subtle control?
I think that's the main one. We've seen them review a number of pharmacy deals in the past. I mean, the industry has been consolidating for decades. Walgreens bought Duane Reade here in New York in 2010. CVS bought Long's in 2008 and Eckerd in 2004. And what they really look for is this cash pay, the impact of this cash paying customer, and the way they kind of mediate this impact is by requiring divestitures. And that's the big question on this particular deal between Walgreens and Rite Aid. What level of divestitures might the FTC ask for?
Do you know offhand what percentage of the revenues of these big ones, Walgreens, Rite Aid, CVS, tends to come from prescription drugs in their revenues or profits as opposed to, you know, all the other toiletries and supplies you find in a drugstore these days?
Sure. Roughly about 70% of the revenues or the sales come from sales in the pharmacy.
Wow. That is really interesting. Is that because their margins are higher on pharmaceuticals than they are on shaving cream?
Actually, no. The margins are lower. What they call the front of store, traditionally, you know, mm-hmm. the beauty products and you
bubble
know,
gum and all the rest,
all that good stuff. They actually make a better margin, but the economies of scale in the pharmacy and the volume is so much greater on the pharmacy side.
That's pretty incredible. And what about the consumer experience in these stores? They're consolidating, but is it clear who offers better service, better facilities, all the rest? That side of it.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up. All of these big three chains are making a push to revitalize their stores. And one of the areas that they're actually focusing on is in that front of store on the retail experience as opposed to the pharmacy side. And you're seeing a lot of pushes into beauty products and healthcare products, home healthcare products. Walgreens in particular has been very strong in this area. Walgreens is a global company. They own the Boots chain in the UK. And Boots has their beauty line that is now offered through Walgreens store here in the U.S.
When are we likely to know if this gets a federal sign-off or not?
Well, the end of the year is the target for both companies. Their drop-dead date is actually at the end of January, so we're hoping to hear something in the next couple months here.
And what's the offer, Walgreens, for Rite Aid? What are they offering to pay? What have they offered?
They offered $17
billion. $17 billion. And if they buy it, it'll be Walgreens all over that?
Yes.
Well, there may be a change in the neighborhood. We'll see. We'll watch and see what the federal government does. Jonathan Palmer at Bloomberg Intelligence, thank you very much for filling us in today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us this hour. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.